I'm Lee, I'm an alcoholic.
Hey Lee.
Well, I'm really fucking nervous right now. I did not want to do this tonight. I don't think people want to do these kind of things. But I said yes, and the truth is I am desperate to fucking stay so clean and sober. Really desperate. That's the only thing I want in life right now. I realize that I don't know what it is about this program. There's a lot of things that I do in this program. I do inventories, I meet with new guys, I do all these different things, and I don't know which one of these things is keeping me sober. So in reality, I just keep on doing the things that are put in front of me. And it's really been, it's been the only way that I think I can be sure that I'm at least doing my best effort to stay clean and sober. I am just a regular garden variety alcoholic. I started drinking when I was young. I increased the amount that I drank, and the consequences increased with that procession. And by the time I started around 13, and by the time I was 16, I was like, you know, in trouble with the law. I had a codependent mom who like threw me into rehab, like, and then showed up to court for me, you know, like, and you know, so like by the time that's like 16 years old, and like, so that's when I realized, you know, oh, I have this problem. And like now it's like 16 years later, I'm 32, and I've just been doing this hokey pokey of trying to get sober and fucking it up over and over again. And now I have 4 months of sobriety, and I'm trying this, I'm still trying. What's different this time is instead of working this program, like prescriptively, I'm trying to do it preventatively. It's kind of like in The Karate Kid, he teaches him to do the wax on, wax off thing, right? Because you're not gonna rise to the occasion. Like, if you're not doing this, if you're not putting this into practice every day, when the shit hits the fan, you just have to, it has to be like a natural movement, a natural gesture to like, yeah, I think you guys get what I'm saying. And I'm not doing the program perfectly. There's like, I think I've been in like 3 relationships in the past 4 months. I steal on the regular. I like to, you know, there's a lot of things that I'm not doing that have been suggested for me to do, but the bottom line is I'm doing all of the things that are in the first 164 pages of the Big Book, and I don't drink and I don't use on a daily basis, and that's, I think that's the most important aspect. But these other things, I think there's an element to like, you know, the truth is like, I want to get better. Like, I don't want to continue to, I'm not just going to continue to be like, I don't want to just be a fuckboy my whole life. You know what I mean? That's not like, that's not the point. Like, I want to progress. I want to become better. And like, and I don't really get to choose like when these things sort of like, I'm humbled by the experience of like the fact that like I'm seeking something outside myself to make myself feel better. And when it doesn't, there's like a real, that void is like, it's really painful. It's like a painful experience. Like I want something, I go after it, and then it doesn't give me what I want. And then I feel this, yeah, this humbling pain. And so, thinking about maybe not doing the relationship thing so much anymore, and like, I don't know what else to say. Talk about the steps a little. I heard something at a meeting a while back, and I thought it was an interesting like breakdown. I like patterns. I think it's a human thing. And like this person said the first three steps are like working on your relationship with God. Step four through step, I think step nine is working on your relationship with, step four through seven is working on your relationship with yourself. And then step eight through 12 is like working on your relationship with others. And I thought it was like a really interesting breakdown, because I'm always trying to figure out like what is really going on with this program? Like, how is it working? And like, I don't know. Recently I've been getting caught up with the idea of like atheism. I think there's people in the program that that are atheists in the program. And they, you know, crew a little bit of sobriety, and I'm like, what is going on with that? Like, is the point of the program to find God? Is the point of the program to be of service? Can you do one without the other? And ultimately, I find that like I don't think I have the luxury to be an atheist. Like that, it's like my dream, but I just like I can't. It doesn't really work. It just hasn't worked for me. Like every time I try, it just kind of like feels like I'm like fall into trouble. And maybe that's the cool thing about this program, is that there's like all these different ways to do it. And I don't know. I just believe in God. And can I end a minute early?
Sure.
Say what? All right.
You said you were going to go 30 minutes.
Okay, that's all I got. Thanks, guys.
Hey, everybody, I'm Sean. I'm an alcoholic.
Sean.
Thanks, Lee, for your lead, man. That was good. That was succinct. And I've been coming to this meeting. Well, I used to come to this meeting religiously. This was one of the meetings that I came to as part of my first 90 and 90. It was the first meeting I ever had a commitment at. It was the first meeting I ever felt as though I was capable of being a member of this fellowship, and actually being not just a member of this fellowship, but being like a useful, helpful, wanted member of this fellowship. I don't come from a place of a lot of self-confidence at all, but when this meeting was over on Shattuck, it was, this meeting used to mean everything to me. I was the chair guy and the literature guy once, and I got asked to speak once at this meeting about 2 years in to my sobriety, and I told the person no, and she was the founder of the meeting. Her and her husband Brian founded this meeting, and it's not my favorite way to share. And she threatened to call my sponsor, and she got in my face and told me that when AA asks, and I was just like, there's no fucking way I'm gonna stand up in front of that crowd, this crowd, and get vulnerable. I wasn't willing. And, you know, like I said, I was willing to be the chair guy. I was willing to be the literature guy. I've been and am currently, again, the intergroup special events coordinator for Alameda County for the fellowship, which is, this is now my sixth or seventh all groups day I'm going to be hosting. Like, that kind of shit I can do all day, man. You know, like, that kind of stuff I love to do, but standing up here and getting vulnerable and letting you people know who I am, man, it's just not my gig. It's not my way. You know, I'll work with new guys all day, but this isn't it. So anyway, I figured when John asked me to speak today, there he is. I thought to myself, what the fuck? You know, I said no a long time ago, and I was actually thinking about coming to this meeting anyway. And I just said, you know, I just felt like, what the fuck? You know, I've had a lot of real emotional issues lately. I hit a guy with my car on purpose a couple weeks ago. He was driving a car. I hit his car. Trust me, I thought a lot about hitting regular. I thought about hitting a lot of people with my car, but I just had all that thought about hitting people in general. But yeah, it felt that, and I didn't pull over, wouldn't stop. I just, you know, he gave me the finger. I clipped him. We had words. I drove away. He chased after me. I got away. I'm waiting for the cops to show up in my apartment. It hasn't happened yet. But anyway, I've been having a lot of emotional tumult. You know, at first it was all, you know, fuck him. And then I looked at my car and I was like, oh, fuck me. And then I thought to myself, oh no. You know, what have I done? I'm 44 years old. I just got 8 years of sobriety in July. That's not emotional sobriety. You know, that's not shit the 44-year-old man should do, or any 44-year-old person should do, that type of behavior. So, you know, what I've learned in this program, and I've been through a lot of shit in this program. I've lost one of my best friends. Actually, two of my best friends in this while I've been sober. I lost a family member. I've lost an apartment. I lost a girlfriend. I lost a couple of jobs. And every single solitary time one of those things happened, it felt earth-shattering, right? Like the earth underneath me just rocked. And every single solitary time, I just, you know, I didn't drink. I didn't use. I did what people told me. What people told me to do was go to more meetings. What people told me to do was get into service. What people told me to do was, you know, it's not as bad as we think it is. You know, I'm not a first responder. I'm not on the front lines. I'm not defusing IEDs in Afghanistan. Like, what I do in my life is not fucking important, you know. And what I do in my normal everyday life is not life-threatening. And it's drinking and doing drugs is not my solution anymore. And so, luckily, by the grace of God and by this fellowship and by working the steps and working with others, I've been able to learn a new way of coping, man. I mean, for me, that's what this program does for me now. You know, it's getting sober was pretty easy for me because I'm a real stubborn motherfucker. It's the staying sober that was hard. It was, you know, choosing a different way to deal with life that was real hard. It was putting myself out there that was real hard. It was all that stuff was real hard. But, you know, thankfully, man, I learned by watching these members of this fellowship, and it's slowly but surely, man, it's finally come around. And 6.5-7 years later, here I am standing speaking at this meeting. So, you know, if I can do it, so can you. But anyway, so my sobriety date is July the 11th, 2011. I have a sponsor. I actively work the steps. Thank God, or who knows who I would have fucking run over. I know I'm not currently working with anybody, but I'm available to work with any new guys if you want what I have. I moved to Oakland to get sober. I moved here in 2011. I was dating this woman who thought it'd be a good idea for me to I I could quit drugs and alcohol if I moved to West Oakland. And I quickly found out you can buy speedballs in West Oakland and alcohol, too. And they don't just sell in San Francisco. So that plan failed. But, you know, I had essentially run out of options over and over in the city. I had lost everything I had, roughly. I was down to a couple of pieces of furniture, down to a couple pieces of clothing, and that's about it. I lost my job. I was moving furniture. I was what we call a lumper on this furniture moving truck on this furniture company in San Francisco. Everybody there was either an illegal immigrant or a federal prisoner, a former federal prisoner. I guess that's the only way I can really describe it. So you know, I basically drank and used drugs down to pretty much a $12 an hour job hauling furniture for a living under the table because I couldn't get a normal job. But anyway. So a little bit of background for me. I started drinking and using drugs really young. I was 13 when I started using. I was born and raised into a family that drugs and alcohol were everywhere. During a time when drugs and alcohol were everywhere, you know, it was on the news, it was on movies, it was in TV, it was, you know, in music that we listened to. I was born in 1975, and so, you know, that whole generation of that whole generation, it just seemed like everybody and everything I saw was drugs and alcohol. One of my earliest memories as a child was cutting up lines of my parents' cocaine that they left on the coffee table. So I knew what drugs were. I knew what a lewd was. I knew what a black beauty was. I knew what a lid was. I knew what all that stuff was, even before I could really whistle or do anything else like that. Even before I could go to school. So. You know, I was a latchkey kid, had zero parental guidance whatsoever. I would wake up in the morning, my mother would be gone, I'd come home from school, she'd be gone. My father was a narcissistic alcoholic, drug addict, he was gone. My brother was 7 years older than me, so he was gone. So I essentially raised myself from a real early age. And we were poor, very poor. I've tasted government cheese on more than one occasion. It's terrible, I don't recommend it. But then there was a lot of dysfunction. You know, my family chose violence, and they chose drugs and alcohol as their means of coping with life when things got hard, when things got difficult. You know, that's what they did. You know, they used and abused, and so as I grew older and things started to get tougher for me. I mean, as a little kid, as a little boy, I mean, I literally had nothing. You know, I had nobody telling me what to do, when to do it, how to do it. You know, my father would, you know, come pick me up on the weekends occasionally, and he'd take me to nightclubs. I didn't go to Little League. I was raised as an adult. I think I was raised to be my parents' partner rather than my parents' kid. And so when we left, you know, the town that I grew up in, which is the town of 10,000 in the middle of nowhere, Minnesota, and we moved to the big city, Minneapolis. You know, I was uncomfortable. I got real uncomfortable. I wasn't raised with boundaries. I wasn't raised to learn how to, you know, with attaboys, and I wasn't raised to learn how to make friends. And so, you know, the only thing I could turn to when I got uncomfortable was the same thing that my folks turned to, and that was drugs and alcohol. And there was enough of it around for me to learn to cope that way as well. So I started drinking when I was 13, and I immediately took to it, man. I loved it, and I drank alcoholically from the get. You know, I immediately stopped going to school. I dropped out of school when I was about the eighth grade, ninth grade. They sent me to one of those woodworking high schools. I don't know if they still do that. Who's young enough? You're young. Well, anyway, I don't know if they still have those. They still ship kids off to build bird baths and stuff like they did when I was at birdhouses when I was a kid. But I couldn't even make it there. And I eventually, as I started to use and drink more, the more and more people tried to tell me to stop, the more and more I tried to do, the more and more I wanted to drink and use. And drinking and drugging from the age of 13, 14, 15 years old was everything and the only thing I ever wanted to do. I fell into a crew of kids who were who were of like mind, who also had parents that weren't around, and you know, they were what we call gutter punks back in the day, and so because they were the first kids to talk to me, I immediately fell in with the gutter punks, and by the time I was 15 years old, they found me in a park in downtown Minneapolis. I was eating dirt and trying to smoke my boot. I don't remember any of this. This is what was on the police report. And I woke up in a hospital about 4 days later, strapped in all 4 points. And I was hallucinating like crazy. I'd eaten this stuff called Jimson weed. And yeah, it was fucking gnarly. Maybe 5 days. I woke up 5 days later and I was strapped down and there was all like these little like figures like doing these like, you know, jumps and things like that. It was like a little circus in my hospital bed. And I would try to get out of bed and I would like just talk to, you know, the nurse came in and she's like, do you want me to turn on the TV? I was like, no, go ahead and you can turn it down. It was nuts, man. It was real fucking crazy, but I really fucking loved it. And so when I got out of the hospital, I got sent off to rehab. So that was my first stint at trying to get sober. This is my third try trying to get sober here. This is the one that's finally taken. But anyway, when I got out of rehab, you know, my mother at the time, she kind of freaked out and she tried to pull in the reins, and I decided just to leave. So I left home when I was about 15, and I hitchhiked to this place called the Rainbow Gathering. Is anybody familiar with the Rainbow Gathering? Yeah. So living on the streets of Minneapolis, we used to drink Carlo Rossi. We'd get a gallon of Carlo Rossi. We called ourselves the Carlo Rossi Posse. And we would get Pfeiffer's beer, which was at the time, it was like, I think it was $6 for a case of returnable bottles. So you spend $6 and you could take the bottle, take the case back, and they gave you $2 back. It was great. But as, you know, me drinking underneath these bridges and these railroad bridges in downtown Minneapolis and St. Paul, I heard about this Rainbow Gathering place. And I heard that they gave away drugs for free. And I heard that you could live out in the woods and they'll feed you and you can, you know, sit in drum circles and do all that shit. I didn't have any interest in doing all that hippy-dippy shit. I was too punk for that shit. But I was into the drugs. So when I was 15, I hitchhiked from Minneapolis to the White Mountains of Vermont. No clothing, no bedding, no food, no water, because I heard that, you know, the hippies were going to take care of me, and well, I was disabused of that shit right away. And it's fucking cold in the mountains. I don't know if anybody's ever been to the mountains, but it's cold and wet, and it sucked. It really, really sucked. There was no drugs, there was no food, there was no Shangri-La that I had hoped for, but I did meet some other punk rockers from Manhattan who had come up thinking the same thing, and we left Vermont after about 5 days, and I hitchhiked down to the Lower East Side of Manhattan, and fell in with a bunch of squatters, and I squatted in New York City on the Lower East Side of Manhattan, and that was it, man. I found my people. I found anarchists. I found drug addicts. I found musicians. I found, like, it, man. I mean, at 15, 16 years old, I mean, I think I look young now. Anybody? No? Imagine how I looked when I was fucking 15. So in New York City, it was, you know, it was a free-for-all back in, you know, the early 90s. This is like 91. And the Lower East Side of Manhattan back then was, I mean, it literally makes the Tenderloin look like Disneyland. I mean, it was, there was burned out buildings and rubble. There was literally the guys with the, you know, the 50-gallon drums of fire standing over the fire, and dudes chasing each other down the street with machetes, junkies on all sides of the streets everywhere just wandering around, picking in the gutters. I mean, I loved it, man. Nobody told me what to do. The cops wouldn't come down there because we would throw Molotov cocktails at them. I had free rent. I moved into this abandoned building down on Houston between A and B, and the whole back end of it was missing. It's a four-story apartment building. The whole back end was missing. It burned away, and I was infested with rats. But it was home. You know, nobody, there was no teachers there to tell me what to do. There was no police there to tell me what to do. There was no parents. You know, I stayed out of the local dealer's way. You know, you went down Avenue D to get heroin. You went down Avenue C to buy crack. By Avenue B, you could get your powder. Avenue A, you got weed. And I just wouldn't go there. I didn't need any of those things. That's kind of the rules. You just, you know, if you don't, you don't go down to Avenue D if you don't want a cop, right? That was kind of the rules of these dudes. They didn't like that shit too much. So for me, it was great. I'd wake up in the morning. We'd go dumpster diving the night before. I don't know if anybody's familiar with that, but in New York, they just take all their trash and they put it on the street corner. And we'd go in these shopping carts and we'd pick food out of the garbage. And wake up in the morning and eat garbage for breakfast and gather our shit. And go sit down somewhere on 2nd Avenue and panhandle for beer all day long. And that was it, man. You know, that was great. I mean, that was what I wanted to say. And I tell this part of the story, and this is, you know, it's a kind of a big chunk of my story. I just, you know, kind of wanted to highlight that, you know, by the time I was 15 years old, I mean, I had literally given up everything in life and put my life in immense danger. Not quite yet. I still have to go to Puerto Rico. I still haven't gotten to Puerto Rico yet. Which I met a girl, a 25-year-old girl in Puerto Rico, in New York City. She took me to Puerto Rico, and that was real fucking crazy. But, you know, by the time I ended up leaving Puerto Rico at 17, I had developed a terrific heroin habit. I was washing pots in a restaurant in a country that didn't speak any English, where they were killing each other for fucking next to nothing. All because I wanted to be able to use and drink the way that I wanted to use and drink. I mean, that was essentially it. I mean, I did all this. I lived this way. I put myself in danger. I told everybody and everybody I know that loved me to fuck off because I wanted to drink and use, man. And there was nothing wrong with what I was doing at this age. And that's what I wanted to do. But, you know, heroin kind of kicked my ass. And I ended up getting my shit together. I called my father, and when I was living in Puerto Rico, and he was on the run from the police. He was living in Costa Rica at the time, and I told him, I was like, man, I'm going to go to prison. I'm going to die if I stay here in PR. And he got on the first flight, and to give him a little credit, he was probably bored, but Costa Rica in the 1990s, I don't think it's quite the same as it is now, but anyway, he came to get me, and you know, I told him I'd pick him up at the airport, but I ended up, like, going on a nod for about 3 days. But anyway, he forgave me. But, you know, as I started to kick, you know, I told my father, like, you got to get out of Puerto Rico, man. There's nothing here for you. And I was like, yeah, you're probably right. You know, I was in Puerto Rico. They had, like, the hierarchy, right? Like, the white-skinned Puerto Ricans are the highest on the hierarchy, and then the darker your skin gets, and then you're Dominican. And then there was me. That was the lowest man on the totem pole in this kitchen's hierarchy. And so I was like, you know, you're probably right. I'm probably not long for this place. And told him, I was like, you know, the only way I'm ever going to go back to the U.S. is if I can drink and use the way I want. And, you know, we thought about going to Miami because he had some people in Miami. And I got to get sober already. I'm not even fucking 20. Anyway, we chose New Orleans. New Orleans at the time was 17. You could drink and use in New Orleans at 17. And so I went to New Orleans. And I just, you know, basically from there on, man, I mean, I ended up kicking heroin. And I ended up getting my life kind of together. And I wanted to meet girls that didn't have scabies. You know, I wanted to live indoors. I wanted to live in a building where I didn't have to piss in a pot. And, you know, I kind of got my shit together. You know, I kind of saw some clarity because I kind of saw the writing on the wall. And New Orleans turned out to be really good for me. I ended up getting my GED. I ended up enrolling in community college. And things started to go fairly right for me. You know, I was still a street hustler. I still, you know, did things that I felt I needed to do. But New Orleans was great because everybody was drinking and drugging the way I was drinking and drugging. So for me, it was riding with the crew. But no matter where I went, no matter, you know, no matter what position or who I was with, I was always still me, right? I couldn't change how I felt on the inside. And that was really the crux of what the problem was with me. I still was insecure. I was still definitely afraid of everybody and everything. I still felt like a fraud. I mean, I went to college, man. I mean, fuck, I didn't even finish eighth grade. And here I am surrounded by all these rich kids, and you know, they're academic. I didn't tell anybody anything. You know, they asked me if I, you know, why I got on the SAT. I made up some bullshit. I'm not even sure if it was right. But you know, I did what I had to do in order to survive, which is the same thing I've always done, man. I could only rely on myself. I could always rely on drugs and alcohol to get me through the next thing. And that's what I did. You know, luckily in New Orleans, man, luckily everybody else was behaving that way. I mean, I can't imagine what it'd be like if I went to school like Indiana or some shit like that. I don't know, maybe it was the same. But, you know, anyway, like a Puritan school, I would have failed out. But, you know, I moved to San Francisco and, you know, I started working and I started doing the things and I started, you know, I fell in with people and things were going okay. You know, I started to make a little bit of money and the people I started hanging out with, like it was started to be pretty good. And then when I started to get a little bit of money, I started to get a little more loosey-goosey. My drinking and my drugging started to be a little bit longer and longer during the day. My work days got shorter and shorter. And, you know, I'd come in at 10, reeking like booze and alcohol, and I'd leave at 3, and eventually I got fucking fired. And everything that I'd had, all the accoutrements that I had acquired in that short period of time, all disappeared. Because, you know, I was an alcoholic, man. I was a drug addict, and people don't drink and use the way I do. You know, at least not, well, you people do. But everybody else doesn't. Most other people don't. And so eventually, you know, friends fell to the wayside, and, you know, I couldn't pay for my car, got impounded a bunch, and eventually they took that thing away, and the girlfriend started to leave, and my friends started to leave. I mean, they got wives and kids and jobs and apartments without 6 other dudes living with them, and I just couldn't get it together, man. And as my life started to just get shittier and shittier and smaller, I couldn't fucking figure it out. You know, even though I knew I was an alcoholic, I was a self-proclaimed alcoholic. But I didn't think that alcohol and drugs was my problem. I didn't think that was the reason why I had, you know, no money in the bank or why I had no friends to rely on. And I ended up selling weed in Golden Gate Park to make a living. I was up on Hippie Hill selling weed to tourists. You know, I mean, I went from making. I mean, I. You know, not for nothing, man. I mean, granted, I'm only an 8th grade educated guy, but I did get my GED, I did get my college degree, I did make 6 figures at one time, and I did have a fucking shit ton of fun and friends and stuff like that. But my drinking and drugging led me to, you know, to selling weed in the fucking trees. I mean, it wasn't great at all. And I actually ended up getting fired by that guy. And, I did convince my coke dealer to let me get on his payroll, so then I ended up becoming a cocaine distributor. I was the guy you called on the phone. I had a little beeper. You call me, beep, and I drive your cocaine, and I ended up doing that. That guy ended up fucking firing me, and you know, I just couldn't get it together, man. I just couldn't. Everything just fucking continued to fall apart and fall apart and fall apart. And there was literally a day where I was banging my head against the wall, trying to figure out what was wrong. And, you know, luckily this woman came into my life who was equally as disastrous as I was, but she convinced me to come here. And, when I moved to Oakland, she convinced me to come to meetings. And I started going to meetings. And I was in the city selling blow. And I went to this candlelight meeting and out at Fort Mason, and I heard Brian H. speak, actually the guy that founded this meeting, and he said something, I don't know what it was, you know, I was high as fuck, I was eating pills like they were M&Ms, and I used to nod out in the room and go do bumps in the bathroom to come out, and he said something, man, that fucking struck me. And I did something I'd never done before, and I went up to a strange man and I asked him for help. I told him who I was. I told him I just moved over to West Oakland. I said I was trying to get sober. I mean, honestly, it was Natalie who was trying to get me sober. I was just trying to get Natalie off my back. But nonetheless, you know, I knew I needed to do something, and he gave me his number and he told me to call him the next day, and I did. And man, I don't know, I don't have no idea, and I wasn't the end of my drinking and drugging, but the fact that, you know, he gave me these numbers and he gave me these things to do, you know, it gave me some semblance of hope. Like, okay, there's something out there. I can still do what I knew. If I need to reach out, then I can always reach out. But I can at least still do what I got to do. Because I didn't think that was the solution. I didn't think that was the fucking problem. But eventually shit just got worse and worse and worse, man. And I went to this little meeting over here on over by the lake in that Lutheran church. I don't even know if that's the meeting there anymore, but this dude, 90 Day Ray, I don't know if you guys know Ray C or not, but Ray C hits me up after the meeting. He's like, hey, dude, let's talk. And we stood on the corner there in front of the Whole Foods, and I talked to this dude for like 30 minutes, man. And I had a pocket full of pills and a pocket full of blow, and I was ready to go fucking rock, and I stood there and talked to this dude for 30 fucking minutes, and that was the last time I got drunk and high. Yeah, it was it, man. I stopped. It was just one of those things. I think the thing that it was, man, is I just think that hearing these guys speak, and after going to so many meetings, just hearing that there is a solution other than my solution. And just getting to that fucking bottom, man, where, I mean, my life, you know, was 2 pints of vodka, fistful of pills, and a gram of cocaine every single solitary day. I mean, my life was this big, and I was tired of it. I was sick and tired of being sick and tired, and I know that sounds cliche, but it was the truth for me. And that was July the 11th, 2011, and I haven't used or drank ever since then. And, you know, it's not... It wasn't easy. It certainly wasn't fun trying to kick on my own, because I certainly wasn't going to ask for help, but I still came to meetings. And I went to a meeting a day on the Saturdays and Sundays. I went to 2 meetings. I came to this meeting, and I went to Dr. Bob's Nightmare over on College Avenue. Sundays I went to Vision for You and some Berkeley meeting, I don't remember, and that was just how my life, that's just what I started doing, man. And I didn't embrace this program at all. You know, I treated this place like a job. I didn't want to be friends with anybody. I had enough homies in the city. I didn't need any girlfriends, because, you know, I had one of those, and holy fuck was she a pain in my ass. I had no car. I had a bike I was delivering furniture. Some dude gave me a bike that he didn't want anymore. And I would just, you know, Google up a meeting, and I would get on this bike, and I fucking lost. I hated this town so much. San Francisco, all the roads are straight, right? If you want to get to the beach, you just head west. Not in Oakland. But anyway, nonetheless, man, I did it. You know, I figured out the bus route, and I did what I needed to do, you know. And y'all told me to come to meetings every day. I came to meetings every day. Y'all told me to start working the steps. I started working the steps. You know, you told me to get with the, to start working with others and being of service, I started, you know, getting to be of service. Like, it just kind of all just started to happen for me, and things started to get good, man. I got a job, I got a car, I started to make some friends, a few friends. I got invited to be the events coordinator. I mean, holy shit, man. I had no idea that I was capable or even wanted to do that shit, but I embraced all that stuff, man. It felt really good to be a part of somebody and something. And then I started dating. And that, if you're new, fucking don't date anymore. That shit got real hard, real fast, all over again. But you know, nonetheless, I mean, I didn't drink it, I didn't use, I made it through it all, and that relationship ended up going away. We weren't compatible for one another, but, you know, again, it was just one of those things where just, you know, life got good and it got bad and it got good and it got bad. And, you know, it's for a stretch, it was bad. I lost my apartment. I didn't have a job. I was, you know, I had to live on my girlfriend's couch. Like, shit sucked for a minute. But, you know, again, like I said at the opening part of the meeting or my share, is that, you know, it never once struck me that drugs and alcohol was going to be a good idea for me. It never once struck me that, you know, that was the solution that I needed in my life now. And so so I didn't, and I made it, and here I am. You know, it's I can literally attribute everything that I have in my life, all the friends that I have in my life, all the job that I have in my life, everything that I do every day, I can attribute and I can draw a line directly to this program. I can draw a line directly to, you know, working these steps and working these traditions and being just being a member, man. You know, it's I haven't done this perfectly, you know. I've stolen in sobriety. I've lied in sobriety. I've done some shady shit, fucked up shit in sobriety. You know, I've never done this program perfectly, but nobody ever asked me to do this shit perfectly. You know, that's not written in the book that it has to be done perfectly. It's not written in the book that it has to be, that I have to have a God. It's a God of my understanding. You know what I mean? You know, now I suit up, I show up, and I shut up, and I become just a member of members and just do the work, man. Don't be a dick. And for me, it's just that simple. And like I said, it doesn't always work. I mean, I think that could be considered a felony hit and run, but, you know, it's just part of the thing, man. I'm not perfect. And if I have to make amends to this man, I'm willing to. You know, if I have to pay up to, you know, pay for this dude's car, I'm fucking totally down. You know, I'm not too big to do that type of stuff. And for me, that's where the relief comes from. It's, you know, being able to look at my part in things and be able to show up and be kind and be patient and be loving and know when I'm wrong and know where my place is. And, you know, it feels really good. You know, I don't know that I would trade all that drinking. I mean, I had a lot of fucking fun, man, out in the streets. But, you know, I definitely don't think I would go back to it. This is so much easier now, you know. It's easier for me to be truthful, you know. I don't have to make as many amends as I used to. I don't have to, you know, hang my head in shame as much as I used to. It's just, you know, if I just live honestly and I just live and allow these principles to kind of guide me, it's just a lot fucking simpler than the way I ever was before. And that's the way I want, man. I want simple. I want an easier, softer way, you know. And that, and to me, now this is it. I mean, it's painful, but, you know, so what? You know, it's certainly better than the alternative. And it's been relieving. And, you know, it's... So my life today, it's full. You know, I've got a lot of friends. I'm going to be done sooner than that. I got a lot of friends. You know, I've got family that I love. You know, my life is full. Sometimes it's full of joy. Sometimes it's full of shit. Sometimes it's full of pain. You know, a lot of times it's filled with, most of the time it's filled with happiness. You know, if I stop thinking about what's wrong and start focusing on what's right in front of me, and then I can live in that, you know, that place of gratitude that I need to be in. I can stay present, and that's where I need to keep my head, and that's where I try. So any of you new guys, you know, man, stick around. Seriously, it's a fuck ton easier, and it's not so bad. And I was talking to this new guy this morning at Dr. Bob's Nightmare, man. That voice in your head that's hearing you, telling you that, you know, you're a piece of shit, or that you're not good enough, or you are too good for, or whatever, that's just a fucking narrative, man. That's just a story in your head that your head's telling you. It doesn't mean shit. We're not thinking about you after you leave this meeting. Sorry. We don't care what kind of shirt you got on. We're not talking about you behind your back. Like, it's just not the way that it is, man. That's just all a bunch of bullshit in your head. But what we do is we will pick up the phone if you call us. You know, we will be there for you if you need us. That's just the way we ride, you know. At least that's the way I ride. So I think that's it. Some, keep it simple, simple. No. Keep it simple, stupid, right? Anyway, thank you.